another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org. And today, I have my very special guest, Stephen Deer, the son of Jack Deer. Stephen, it's so good to have you on here. We have chatted a bit through email after we were connected, and all of the pieces are coming together for me in ways that it'll be a little bit of a surprise to you, I think, to even hear it on this podcast. We haven't yet spoken about it, but we've been getting so many requests to dig into the history of the creation of some of the big churches in the NAR and the movements leading up to it. And the linchpin to all of it appears to be Paul Kane. And so I have been contacted by numerous people, from the researchers working with me to people who have escaped the New Apostolic Reformation, especially with the fall of, you know, what happened at IHOP and all of that. People are wanting to know more about Paul Kane and his connection to William Branham. And I was mentioned it to you right before this podcast, but your email sparked a memory for me, and I was able to dig up a lot of correspondence that I had between myself and Paul Kane. And anyway, all of this to say, in the upcoming weeks, the plan is we will start to produce some of the research. I can't say everything that he told me in the conversations. There's some things I have to hold, but I'm going to start revealing some of the things that have been said, and other people are soon to be sharing more information about Paul Kane. But all of that is, it's the leading up to our discussion today about your experience with, you know, your father, the New Apostolic Reformation, Paul Kane. You have a testimony and a lot of history that I think our listeners would be just fascinated to hear.
Well, I hope I don't disappoint. What you're getting from me is not an expert opinion into theological. I'm just sharing my experience and observations from being around Paul and observing some of the themes that have been on your podcast and have been present in the whole IHOP controversy. Or scandal. I'm not quite sure what to call it now. It's kind of...
I just call it a mess.
Yeah. So, and I've never been to IHOP. I was partially kind of got interested in this because of Paul. And trying to, just kind of like untangle what I grew up with and how much was true, how much wasn't. And it's a long, long process.
Yeah. And you know, that's the common thing everybody who has contacted me about this has said. They want to know what was real and what was not, because there were clearly things about this that were real, but there was a whole lot of fiction mixed in with it. And how do you correctly divide what's true and false among a mass ball of deception? So maybe it would be good if we just take a moment and have everybody, you know, tell a little bit about yourself, have everybody learn who is Stephen Deer, and who some of our listeners probably don't even know who Jack Deer is. So it'd be good to, you know, give some information about your father, but yeah, just tell us a little bit about yourself.
So, you know, I grew up I'm a pastor's kid. My dad, he was a seminary professor at Dallas Theological Seminary for, 13 years, something like that. Specialized in ancient Semitic languages. One time, I think he knew like a dozen or something. And was a cessationist. I didn't believe that the gifts of the Spirit, we're talking about like healing, prophecy, tongues, things like that. You know, those things had kind of ceased or faded away with the death of the last apostle. Through a conversation with John White, a British psychiatrist, well-known British psychiatrist, author, and missionary, he kind of embarked on this new path and kind of like changed his mind about the gifts of the Spirit and came to believe that they were for today. And right as that was happening, you know, he was fired from his job at the seminary because of his association with one of the leading charismatic figures at the time, John Wimber. They said you have to. My recollection is that they said that, you know, if you don't stop associating with Wimber, we're going to have to terminate you, even though he was tenured. And he said, I'm going to keep on being friends with Wimber. And so they terminated him. And then around that time is when Paul Kane kind of entered our lives. A little bit about me. I grew up around a lot of these leaders that we're discussing now. Paul, Rick Joyner, Mike Bickle, Bob Jones. By the time I got to college, adulthood, and stuff like that, the charismatic church, it was something I wasn't super attracted to anymore. And I, you know, like the churches I would go to, I moved around a lot. I was a reporter for about 20 years for different newspapers and stuff. And so, I would attend different churches and stuff, but, it was never, That I was kind of removed from that world, but was always getting reports about, you know, all these people who I knew and who, you know, whose kids were at our house, and you know, that's, and then, you know, I'm a consultant, I do media relations, opposition research, things like that, and the IHOP thing happened, and it's like, the first time I heard the allegations, I was just like, I was kind of surprised, but then kind of wasn't, especially after what happened with Paul Kane, nearly 20 years earlier.
It's kind of funny, you being a minister's son. I wish that every minister's child who is in this movement and all the various splinter groups would just stand up and say, hey, I walked away from this because, and then tell the reasons why they walked away. Because so many children who were, you know, their parents were leaders in this and the movements that created this, they saw things that nobody else saw. And it's really hard for them to believe because they know some of it is hocus pocus. They, mm-hmm. you know, you'd be around these big meetings and then everybody's fascinated with what's happening. Well, then you get to hear the conversations afterwards and you know, the two don't always match. And so ironically, I believed all of it hook, line, and sinker until I was age 37 and I walked away. I was smacking my head. I was like, you know, I heard all the conversations after the services and I knew people who are in the ministry who didn't believe any of it, and yet some of them are holding pastoral positions and positions of rank at minimum, and it's all because, you know, there's so much money flowing through it, I think is the way I would describe the reason why they do what they do. But you mentioned Paul Kane and his allegations of what happened, and which led to his public confession. And right before this podcast, I started pulling up my notes on my conversations with Paul Kane that we had, I think it was 2014, if I remember correctly. And it was kind of funny because when he called me, I knew who he was. I did not know the depth of the connections. And at that time, I had no idea that there was such a thing as the New Apostolic Reformation. I just knew that there was Paul Kane, and he was in bed with all these charismatics. And I had read about him first because he was one of William Branham's proteges. And he openly mentioned that whenever William Branham could not go into a country for to escape prosecution, I guess, is what the reason was. But like such as Germany, Paul Kane is the one that William Branham would send in his place. So he was more than a protege. He was his proxy in some cases. And so I knew who he was. And I knew, I had read his confession of his alcoholism and his sexual immorality. And as he's talking to me, I had, you know, I'm pulling up my notes on my computers, and as he's talking to me, I'm looking through his confession just to try to get my bearings of who this guy is. And he started going into, he had read about some of the things that were said by leaders in the Branham movement about his homosexuality, and he blatantly denied it on the phone. And I said, but I've got your testimony right here. And I kind of threw him for a loop, and he was a little disturbed. We also sent the same thing via email. He vehemently denied all of those accusations, which gets really interesting when you think about the scope of this and, you know, his influence on all these ministries.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's interesting that he would deny something that's so public, but I mean, I don't know. It's not surprising. And to be honest, I didn't know what NAR meant before the IHOP thing. I hadn't even thought about it. It wasn't on my radar as a, but then I start, there's a lot of overlap with NAR and, or people who are described as NAR. It's kind of seems to me like no one wants to really own that label. You know, the things that you hear to kind of like defined as NAR, like these different offices and the amount of control that goes with them, they seem to be, the characteristics, you know, are present, but never really labeled, like in a lot of cases. And I'm thinking of like, you just don't hear outside of like Peter Wagner. In terms of looking over this stuff, it's out in the open, but never defined.
Yeah. Well, and it's hard to define. I think that's the reason why it got that label, because what else do you call this thing? It's a spider web of networks of different groups of which have varying agendas, and of which some are really benign. They're not, some of them are just regular churches, but they're in the same network. But then you've got the extreme versions of those churches and its doctrine, and you see the mega churches. You know, I think that's why they use that term, because Wagner popularized the notion that we need this, it was a church growth movement, we need all of this growth, we need these mega churches, and God is in the mega church kind of thing, right? So what do you call this umbrella? And I think that's why he became, you know, he is the one that got the title. But it's very much the same in the Branham organizations. When I mentioned the you know, the white supremacy history of Branhamism and the ties to Christian identity, well, probably 80% of the churches just vehemently deny it because they're actually not a part of that. They have no idea that that is their roots. They you know, they're so far disconnected. But see, they're part of the same network and they have the same foundation, and unless somebody is to open up the covers and look what's underneath, you know, underneath the foundation of this thing, they have no idea. So I think that's why it got branded as the NAR.
Huh. I mean, that's interesting. The other aspect of some of these churches is that they, in my view, like from what I, just my vantage point, is that they tend to be pretty insular. And so they may not be, they're not, not predisposed to having somebody kind of like look under the hood, you know, look under the hood or look outside themselves that much. And because of that, I think that's another reason why you see a lot of weird things, is because they're not being, there's no accountability with other bodies. They're allowed to kind of like just be this kind of like their own biosphere, and whatever grows out of it, grows out of it, I guess. I mean,
yeah,
that's what it seems like to me.
Yeah, very much so. And not just that, the suppression of information. They, right, they try to, I have friends who are working on exposing some of the extreme doctrines of the NAR, and whenever one is released of something horrific that an NAR leader has said, they will issue copyright strikes against fair use content to try to bring it offline so that the public is unaware that they said these things.
It's the control of a, well, I think in IHOP's case, it's like the control of a story, of a narrative, of a long narrative. And that's drawn people there. And it's like, if there's any part of this, you know, if anybody starts pulling on this thread, on this history, there's almost like this ethos that it's all going to come undone.
Yeah,
that's what it seems like. I'm curious, why did Paul call you? I am surprised by that.
Well, years ago, see, Paul Kane, as I mentioned, was William Branham's protege, his proxy. He was a Branhamite through and through. He was deeply involved in the Latter Rain movement. And when William Branham's, what was his third, is either his third or his fourth campaign manager, who also happened to be homosexual, which is also ironic, he began a worldwide series of tours in which, you know, William Branham and Paul Kane and others were involved with. So Kane is deeply embedded in the Branhamism. Somebody sent me an actual laying on of hands, I guess is what you call it. Paul Kane laying his hands on Chris Reed. I want to say this was 2000. It was like 2 years before he died, 1 or 2 years before he died. And he is praying that people will understand who William Branham truly was, and essentially passing the torch to Chris Reed of Morningstar, Daystar, to try to carry the torch of Branhamism. So he was a Branhamite through and through. Well, back then I had reached the point in my research where I had discovered that not only was it tied to some very dirty things, such as the white supremacy, much of it was fraudulent. And I, too, for years, I did not know why he called me, but I have since learned that Paul Kane was, he got referred to by another person who knew him as allegedly as the fixer of all of these movements. Paul Kane is the guy that would come in and do the cleanup should something get exposed. And apparently there's some large sums of money being exchanged. I won't get too deeply into that, but apparently he was calling to try to halt what I do. And so we first exchanged a few emails, and he wanted to call me immediately and talk to me. And he knew my grandfather. He had been to, obviously he'd been to the church. My grandfather's church was the Branham Tabernacle. And he was very surprised that I was publishing the white supremacy information. He liked denying the sexual misconduct. He also denied all of the many ties to white supremacy. Yet, you know, just like his confessions of sexual immorality, I also had up the timeline. So I knew he was there at key events where leaders of white supremacy were involved, or William Branham was speaking, you know, Christian identity doctrines very openly. So he knew through and through that this was tied to white supremacy. But he wanted to deny it, and he was, I don't know if you've probably been around these people where they do this, but they try to subject you, and mentally they try to take control of your head. I grew up in a world where this was done to people, and I recognized it afterwards, not while I was doing it, but I had this mental thing where when somebody tried to do this to me and they tried to force me into subjection, I naturally knew how to get out of it because I watched people who were doing this sort of thing. So as he's trying to manipulate me, I'm manipulating him in the opposite direction. And that's whenever I brought up the, well, here's your confession, Paul, and just totally derailed his train of thought.
How did he respond to that when you brought that his confession up?
Paul, like in the email, he vehemently denied it. He said it was untrue, unfounded, that people were trying to smear mud. And I looked at it and I saw this is a written confession from him, as I understand it. I just looked at it.
Magazine, right?
Yeah, Charisma or something like this. I'll try to pull it up for the video feed of this podcast. But, you know, this came from him. So I knew he is the one that did it. And I could have called him out on it, but I've learned, you know, two things. Number one, if I'm talking to somebody who's a rank and file member, they may be so manipulated and under the mind control that they may not understand that they believe two things at the same time that are opposing thought. That's very frequent in these movements. Now, Paul Kane is a different category because he is one of the predators. So I knew he wasn't that, but at the same time, I knew if I were to call him out, I might shut him up, and I wanted to hear more of his information. And so I'm glad that I did, because this series of conversation continued for quite a few more times.
Yeah, I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall for that one just over here, because after his exposure in late 2004, I mean, I would get Facebook requests from him every once in a while and stuff like that, but always rejected them. I think, you know, another relative also got Facebook requests. And he, occasionally, every 3 years or so, he would reach out to my dad and try to reconcile, but it was like he would never, there were some things that he did that he just would never own up to, or never fully acknowledged the extent of what he did. And yeah. And I don't care. I mean, frankly, there's a lot of polarization these days. You see it in the IHOP thing. One thing that seems to cross, or it has a, in the church can cross political divide is a sexual, clergy sexual abuse. And, you know, it's like that one time you have like people who are, have really radically different views from one another, kind of working alongside. And
yeah, there is a lot of that. And I haven't put all the research together. I don't want to call it out and get it incorrect, but we do have enough pieces of the puzzle that makes it paint a picture that looks very much like there were multiple aspects to the misconduct. When you take into consideration, I mentioned before that William Branham's campaign manager was homosexual. Paul Kane specifically mentioned reading a testimony by Lee Vail, who was William Branham's publicist, where Vail was naming the homosexual as attracted to William Branham's ministry. And surprising to find out, not only was his campaign manager homosexual, the two men who traveled with him everywhere recording his sermons, literally William Branham's scribes, were two homosexual men. And So you've got this party of homosexual men. They went into Germany, as I mentioned, and Paul Kane was there. Well, the security detail that was with them in Germany was a pedophile who almost got arrested in Germany, and he and his community, his cult following, who were in the Lateran movement, they were beholden to William Branham, they moved into Chile and set up a torture compound where they were sexually molesting children and grooming children to be sexually molested, boys, and in so much that they set up a hospital in Chile, and they would screen children who were, it was like a charitable organization. You know, if you're too poor, come to our hospital, we'll give your child free or very inexpensive care. Well, then children were disappearing from the hospital and they were being taken into the colony as subjects for child molestation charges. Now, I can't directly tie that to Paul Kane. That's just a piece of the puzzle. But I do have witnesses who tell me that Kane was involved in multiple similar things. And the reason the allegation surfaced is because there were a number of allegations, not just one. So when you add all these pieces together, this paints the picture that is very, very bad. which would, again, lead to why he would want to contact me, because as soon as I got to the bottom of all of this, then his whole world comes crumbling down, right? So I think that's why he contacted me. But
yeah. What I observed of him and stuff like that, we hadn't done that, and kind of like how just like, you know, something I learned from the whole thing. First I meant to be clear, like I don't have a problem with homosexuality. What I have a problem with is people taking somebody's faith and using it to manipulate them into sexual acts, to taking away their control. And that's what Paul did. Exploiting somebody, exploiting a child, the innocent, somebody who's, and if Paul had done that to women, I would have as much of a issue with it.
Absolutely.
And the hiding, the lying and stuff like that. That is where I met, as I said, you know, as soon as my dad was coming into the gifts of the Spirit, Mike Bickle introduced him to Paul Kane. I think John Wimber had to kind of like let him know about Mike, and he'd met Mike, and Mike had told him, hey, one of the awesome, you know, greatest prophets in the nation is right there next to you in Dallas. And he came to our house for dinner. We started having dinners with him at our house in Texas. And I would have been maybe 11, 10 or 11 at the time. And so Paul was kind of a fixture of our lives. My parents gave him their house, or kind of gave it to him, I guess, whenever they moved from Texas to California to be part of the vineyard. He was kind of like viewed as a person whose word was synonymous with God. And I think that the issue, Paul was able to create such a incredible persona of himself that it was very easy to equate his words with the words of God. He was like a shortcut to God.
Yeah.
And I think when a thing or a person becomes a shortcut to God, that is when you're looking to them, it's diverting your, you know, it's diverting your attention away from, you know, away from what's true. And so I, you know, if you start thinking like the warning sign is like, if you start thinking like, how would so-and-so view this, or how would, if that is what's dominating your actions and your thoughts and stuff, or before I do this, I need to make sure that this prophet has prayed about it and given the okay, you know, I think that's a major warning sign. And that's kind of like how, but that's how, you know, I grew up. And, and Paul was very, you know, he was a disaster on stage. Disaster on stage, but, you know, it could seem to have a prophetic gifting. What I'll say is I have experienced like supernatural events and just instances where I'm just like, I can't explain this and stuff like that. Personally, I've been racking my brain and I can't remember that with Paul growing up. I mean, I was told different things. Like my dad will talk about stories and, you know, where, and he's going through some health age-related health issues right now, that had some surgeries and stuff like that. It's kind of like a little bit out for the last few months, have been out of public view, or, you know, where else he would be more vocal about some of these things. That's how we grew up. And then, and you know, different people will tell some amazing stories. Like my dad would tell stories about how Paul could read his thoughts at times in a way that he couldn't explain. Like he would be on the front row of like a staff meeting or some meeting at the Vineyard, and Paul is talking to the audience and like scanning them, and all of a sudden he stops and he says, "Jack Deere, what are you doing thinking about your hunting dog Skipper?" And my dad, when he moved to California, you know, he used to love to quail hunt, and we had hunting dogs, and he said, when Paul said that, in his mind, his mind had drifted back to Texas, and he was reaching through this chain link fence to pet this pointer, English pointer that he had, and he said he didn't know how Paul had any way of knowing that. And there's like, and that's kind of like one example and stuff. But looking back, what Paul did, it created the aura of exclusivity around him. It was like, you know, being close to him. He did a number of things that were manipulative and whatnot. But there's a lot of stories. I mean, I knew a woman that who was devastated when she learned what happened to Paul, but was, you know, would accompany him to a lot of different meetings. Who swore that Paul, you know, came into an insane asylum, prayed for, and got her out. And ironically, the woman's husband hated Paul, and he would say, "Hey, you know, one day you're going to understand why I feel this way about him. One day you'll know." And when everything transpired back in 2004, it became clear. And, you know, one of the kind of more interesting aspects of this is that there's this mythology about Paul that seemed to kind of grow up, was allowed to grow in Kansas City, that I just had no clue of. So that he would, you know, the CIA thing kind of throws me for a loop. I'm not sure that he was actually ever working for the CIA. I mean, I just haven't seen the evidence, you know. And the reason I say that is because Paul I think I would have known about it if he was working for the CIA. He just could not keep stuff like that under his hat unless it was damaging.
I don't know that I would necessarily call it the CIA, but he was working with CIA operatives. And the things that are public that you can look at. So there is this group, you can watch the Netflix documentary called The Family. It's the, you know, you've seen the documentary where they're influencing senators and congressmen, et cetera. Well, William Branham's and Paul Kane's campaign manager during those revivals was a director on the board of that institution that was establishing those things. And they were establishing those in a network globally. It wasn't just in Washington, D.C. So when you read about the National Prayer Breakfast and all of the chaos that ensues because the evangelicals are persuading politics, etc., and you find this big war between liberals and evangelical Republicans, we'll picture that globally because it's not just in the United States that this is happening. So Paul Kane was involved with all of that, and this guy likely was CIA. I don't know. There's no way to prove that, but his name was William T. Frary von Blumberg. The adopted cousin of Adolf Hitler's Minister of Defense, Werner von Blumberg. So this guy had a presence in Germany, and that's why Paul Kane got involved with Germany. And then they set up the colony that I mentioned. Well, that colony was also tied to the Nixon prior to the Nixon administration, but Nixon was also involved in it as president and vice president. Nixon gave these guys charge at the National Prayer Breakfast to use their religious influence to sway the mindset against communism and help stir up the communist scare. So there's all these government ties. And then beyond that, there's some information I can't yet release, but hopefully soon I'll be able to. But it appears that he was at minimum working with operatives who were working in MKUltra, potentially. It was either that or a division of the government that existed after that. So I wouldn't say directly CIA, but I can assure you that there were likely CIA operatives in those meetings, because when you think of National Prayer Breakfast globally, it would be stupidity if the United States didn't put CIA ops in those prayer breakfasts around the world. It's a golden opportunity. Why would you not do it? But anyway, you mentioned, I want to circle back to one thing you said, because I feel this is important to stress. You were talking about homosexuality and your views. My views on homosexuality have also changed significantly. I keep this podcast historical, and I try not to get into theology. I'm not a preacher. I let people decide for themselves. And what's funny about this is, within Americanized religion, it's such a divisive issue. You have people who are supportive of the gay and lesbians, and you have people who aren't. I just walk the middle of the line. I say, ask your pastor about it. But that's the position I take. But I too, like you, I want to, the reason I'm bringing this up, I too feel the same way. If Paul Kane were doing the same thing against women, it would be just as equally bad. And now we see the allegations against Mike Bickle, which, in my opinion, are just as bad as what Paul Kane did, maybe even worse, I don't know. But you have all of this mess, and there's this pattern of this mess. So it's not just one person. And as I understand it, Paul Kane was the fixer, and he was the one who, he knew which people were involved in these things, and he knew how to push their buttons if they stepped out of line. Sometimes it was threats with exposing them. Sometimes it was money, you know, et cetera. He would try to buy his way out of things. But you have some correspondence between your dad and Paul that is very interesting when you consider the fixer aspect of everything.
I would get my dad would forward these things to me every once in a while. So let me wrap up what happened, because things will make a little bit more sense. So Paul is like this revered figure, and I think after like mid 90s, you know, I'm still around Paul all the time. When I was in college at the University of Missouri, you know, he was in Kansas City. If I needed to go park my car somewhere, or, you know, I would call him and go to his house, you know, his duplex right there off of behind IHOP, what became IHOP. Mid 2000s, I think his drinking just got out of control. Like, he was in the hospital, and it was just like, doing bizarre things that, some of the stuff I can say, but some of it's other people's stories. And I think there's some people that, are going to be coming out soon to maybe talk on some of the stuff. But, some of the stories just kind of like, getting drunk, wandering through the streets, and no one knew where he was, you know, about to have a heart attack in some instances. And so they were, I think, you know, my dad and Rick, and I think to some extent Mike, they were all trying to, you know, from what I was told at the time, and you kind of always have to say that when you're dealing with these situations, because they were trying to figure out like how to get him out of deal with the alcoholism. And during that process, it finally surfaced that in a way that Paul couldn't deny that he had been abusing that he was a sexual predator and he was kind of given a choice, like, you know, you stay here, you're not leaving. I think they were in North Carolina at the time this confrontation took place, and it was like, if you leave here, we're going public about everything. And I think from what I was told, things got really vicious during some of those conversations. And it was, you know, Mike, Rick, and my dad and Paul. And one of the things that surfaced was that Paul recorded everybody that he talked to and used that against them. I mean, threatened them with the release of those of tapes. And, you know, there was, I don't know that it's totally fair to, I'm comfortable with, like, talking about my own family stuff. But, you know, when my mom had a drinking problem at the time, and I think they had talked to Paul about a lot of this stuff, about her issues. So he was threatening my dad with that. So I think you'll see some hints of that in those emails to release that. And my dad was like, you know what, go ahead. And he had something he threatened Rick with. And he has something he threatened Mike with. And from what I was told, Mike was what he had on him was his affairs with women. And that was, like, open at them. But everybody was like, you know, Rick was like, I don't care if he says what he, you know, what he has on me supposedly isn't even true. I don't care. He can release it all day long. And then Mike said something similar to say, it wasn't just, and it wasn't just that, you know, them that he recorded. He was recording people at the time that he was doing it, and he had different explanations for it. I mean, if you think about who all Paul talked to, there's some interesting implications about recording a lot of your phone conversations.
When he got it honest, right, in the Branham cult, every minister has all of the dirt on the other ministers. And if one steps out of line, the threats to be exposed. It's like a Christian mafia. You know, if you step out of line, we're going to make you and your family pay. And you're gonna get a horse's head on your bed like they did in The Godfather. It's just so corrupt, you know. And as I understand it, that's part of what led to, I'd read prior to our conversations via email, I'd read the chapter that was missing from the book that your dad was going to put in there. Can you talk a little bit about that? You know, why he held it back, what was in the chapter?
I put the draft chapter on my Substack page just because there was a request for it, you know? And so that chapter was kind of like, it was more of an unvarnished view of Paul, where he was and he was talking about his. It was a lot more. It was very revealing, and he wasn't pulling any punches in that chapter. And that chapter was not given to him given to Mike directly, but somebody else, you know, who was a reader of the, this was a revision to one of his books. I gave it to Mike, and then Mike emailed him twice about it. And I had read both. Well, no, I may have had both emails, but I think I only glanced at the second one at the time. And it was right before his book was going to be published. And, Mike was like just making such a hard push, and, you know, for him to take that chapter out of his book, And at the time, because you mean, you know, this makes you seem bitter, then using all kinds of different reasons. And I'm not going to recommend your books anymore if you do it, if you do this. And, you know, and it was very threatening, but then he would say, oh, I'm not, I would never threaten you. Like that, like there's all these, you start looking at how these guys talk and there's all these contradictions. It's like, bam, I would punch you in the face. You know, I would never strike her. It's, they think that their words negate their actions. And, and maybe sometimes they do, but if you, but that's a a pattern doing the opposite of what you say right in front of somebody.
Very much like the mafia, right? This was a Christian mob.
I wouldn't call it Christian, I guess.
Yeah. Christian in quotes. It was a quote Christian quote mob.
No, yeah. I don't want to like screw up anybody's label or name. I never read the completed version of that chapter. I just said, hey, just my advice was rework the chapter. You can still keep everything in there you want. Just reframe the beginning and then no one can say you're bitter if you do it like this. And I just kind of like gave him, and he kind of followed it. And then that's what wound up in the book, but it wasn't, he did pull back a lot more than I realized. And I was rebuilding a house that I was a general contractor on my house at the time. And I couldn't, I wasn't paying real close attention until this happened. Then I just looked at it and I was like, man, this is what it reminded me. I read the email and again, because I just did a search through my email and it was pulling up a lot of different things. And I was like, oh, this sounds so similar to what was sent to an email that it has been published that was sent to Jane Doe's husband by Mike Bickle. And so like the speech patterns are the same, the contradictions are the same. It's not as frenetic or whatever. It's not as spastic or hyper or some of the communication that Mike had with Jane Doe's husband, but the same characteristics are there. And so, you know, what kind of led up to the publishing of the second chapter is there was a statement that my dad, given his name to, it was issued by a group of charismatic leaders. And we had talked about him doing a statement before that. And there were just some issues with it because, you know, when someone's been your friend for 20, 30 years, you know, and it turns out they're not who they say they are. You kind of want to talk to them before, you know, you just haul off. But there had been enough people that had been rejected that Mike had rejected from contacting him. And it was apparent that, you know, people had already gone to Mike and asked him to repent. And yeah. And so I think enough time had gone by and enough of the allegations had been substantiated that obligation kind of like ceased to exist. And so he came out with another statement just to clarify a few things. And then there were a lot of requests to publish that unpublished chapter. Sure. So that's kind of how everything came about.
What do you know about, you know, there's several claims where he's working with the elite in Washington and other countries. What do you know about that?
I know that he had a meeting with Herbert Walker Bush. That meeting was not real productive. I think Paul was not a fan of the Bushes, and he even kind of like disparaged them during that meeting, and said Bush wanting to know where Noriega was. It was when they were looking for Noriega. And I don't know that Paul was, from what I gather, Paul was not helpful with giving the whereabouts of Noriega. He met with Clinton twice that I remember. My younger sister was present for one of them. That was me, not in the room, but she was in DC with some of the people who'd set up the meeting. And we talked about this recently. Like, she was, got a personal tour of the White House and stuff. Well, while this meeting was like happening, and she remembers them, kind of like all reconvening, and it was a horrible, it was an abysmal failure. Like, I can't recall any of these meetings ever having any real effect. It was other than to prop up Paul's image of as this incredible prophet. And he kept everything, all these the pictures of the meetings, he kept them all in a leather-bound book that was really prominently displayed in his house, or that he kept with him at times, And so these were like, it was like a point of like credibility for him and stuff. But but nothing came at the meetings. And then you hear like these stuff that was coming out of IHOP, like Saddam was like requesting to meet Paul. That was like, after he'd been captured. But, my dad and Mike said, no, he can't go. He's, never happened. It's total bullshit. There's a lot of and so I don't. There's something going on there with Kansas City and Paul Kane, and Paul kept his house there until he died.
Yeah. So for the people who were in Kansas City and all of this is happening, and you've been in communication with some of them, I'm certain people are escaping, mm-hmm. and they're realizing this thing was not what it seemed. What advice would you have for those people?
Welcome to freedom. It's going to be hard. And I think, I was talking to someone recently and they said, I did just accept a lot of these things. And to be honest, it was kind of easy to let have somebody do the thinking for me and stuff. I'm being told what to believe and stuff. And I think now, if you're walking out of this, I would say that you now have the freedom to choose. You always had it, but now you can choose what you believe. You can look at the stuff for yourself, really examine it and believe. If they want to believe everything that after like a critical examination, if they want to believe everything that Mike Bickle taught them, great. But try to like see it from different perspectives. Look at the criticism of it. Don't become so. I'm now I'm talking to people who are there. I mean, just be willing to open your eyes. And one of the things that I've kind of like struggled with in this is that watching people come out of this, and maybe you can speak to this. I mean, this was a question. So I was going to ask you kind of like the same question, because there's this mentality from the people that are coming out. It's I don't think it's true. I think it's a lie. But it's like, man, I spent 15 years here. I spent 5 years here. I spent 20 years here. All that time was a waste. And I just don't believe that's true. That's true. Did you think all your time in that environment was a waste? Like, how there's another story, I think, that's there. And I think that is that there's probably something very redemptive.
You know, whenever I first left this, you go through all the stages of emotion. So first you're angry at what they did to you. You aren't really thinking in that way. You're just mad because these people deceived you, you know, and many of these people, your friends, they cut you off, your family cut you off. But then you go through all the stages of grief, and where you end up is deep sorrow for the people in it. And then after that subsides, then the reality hits you. Oh my gosh, I was in this thing, and look at the wasted years I had. Look at how hard it was. Now, what do I have now? What do I have to show for all that time that I put in there? Everybody who leaves, that's one of the thoughts that they're going to get. And where you can dwell on that and you can stay in there forever, it'll consume you. I chose to rise above it, and wasn't easy. I'm not going to lie. It took a lot of work to rise above that. Where I ended up was, I tell people that it was as though I had been raised in a POW camp in Vietnam. And all I knew was Vietnam. And all I knew was what my parents told me about the United States and what freedom is like in the United States. I never knew freedom. I was in a POW camp. And then one day I was rescued and taken to the States, and here's freedom. And I, now that I'm here on the United States, I want to explore everything. I want to live. I want to be excited. That moment hit me. I'll never forget it. You see, I'm a musician. I see that you are too. You got some nicer guitars than I have hanging up there. Well, I'll never forget running up to my son's room upstairs. I think he was like 14 years old at the time. And one of the things in the Branham cult, you weren't allowed to listen to any music unless it was the 1950s style old gospel. And I heard Bon Jovi's Dead or Alive for the first time, and I got so excited, I ran upstairs. I told my son, you got to hear this, man. And so we enjoyed a moment together. There were many moments like this where I got to enjoy new things. So it was as though I experienced my childhood because I had risen above it. And, you know, there's some danger in that as well. I know people who, they weren't allowed to do lots of things, so they said, well, by golly, I'm going to go do all of them. But by and large, the majority of the people, they approach it with the mindset of an adult. So sometimes they're going to do things that other adults wouldn't do. And I look at it, you know, some of them are in our support groups and they talk about it. I just kind of ignore it because in normal parenthood, your children are going to go explore new things that they know they're not supposed to do because they want to see do they like it or not. And the parents are scolding them, now don't do that, but they realize that that's part of life. You want to find who you are. And all this to say, there comes a point if you rise above it where you have to find out who you are, what you believe, what you stand for, what are your freedoms, what are your boundaries. And I simply chose to rise above it. And to anybody who is escaping these things, that's my advice. When you escape, rise above it.
Yeah, I mean, I like what you said about it. I like just being able to like kind of reinvent your, and I maybe that's the wrong word, but I don't know, kind of experience the world for the first time.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for doing this. I'm sure our listeners are going to be very excited to see you. I'm going to throw a link to your website up where people can read the hidden chapter that nobody was supposed to see. So we'll have access to that, and there'll be more information about Paul Kane to come very soon. I'm still working through everything and that strategy, and there's only one of me, and I have some researchers helping me, but putting all this together, it's a great, great effort, a lot of time spent. So if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For an overview of the historical research of William Branham and the healing revivals, read Preacher Behind the White Hoods, A Critical Examination of William Branham and His Message, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.